Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a pretty focused mission, actually. We're looking at how individuals, and maybe especially leaders, can navigate those really deep, profound wounds, things like betrayal, loss, and how they do that without, you know, losing their moral center or just collapsing into cynicism. Our source material for this is, well, it's quite intense. It's an integrative framework, basically a detailed roadmap, and it blends spiritual wisdom with some pretty cutting-edge psychological research.
It really is a comprehensive guide, I think, because it accepts that these kinds of wounds, the ones that just shatter trust, well, they need more than just one approach, more than just therapy or just prayer, for instance. This framework, it's specifically built for people looking for what it calls a faithful, trauma-aware approach. Mm-hmm. So it gives you both the, let's say, theological language to actually articulate the suffering, mm-hmm. and also the practical schools to manage the fallout.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're diving into what's essentially a detailed curriculum. It's like a blueprint for developing ethical resilience and for moving towards repairing trust eventually. The goal here is pretty simple. We want to pull out concrete knowledge, actionable practices, things that you, the listener, can apply pretty much immediately, whether you're leading a team, serving a community, or maybe just trying to make sense of a personal crisis. Because this material, it moves way past just the surface level of feeling hurt. Huh. Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. The framework, right away, it establishes that not all betrayal is the same. It forces us to differentiate the types of trust that have actually been ruptured. What are the key categories of betrayal we really need to get our heads around to see the full scope of the harm?
Well, we're looking at three really crucial dimensions here of ruptured trust. There's interpersonal, institutional, and spiritual betrayal. Now, interpersonal, that's the one most people recognize, right?
Mm.
A friend, a partner, maybe a colleague betraying you. Institutional is often, well, sneakier, more insidious. That's harm caused by organizations, maybe churches, systems, places that were supposed to provide safety or support.
And spiritual betrayal, that one feels like it's often the hardest to even name. That feeling when your fundamental beliefs, your whole understanding of the bene fin or the moral order, it just feels completely undermined by what's happened.
Precisely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the source really stresses that these ruptures don't just cause emotional pain. They actually change the way our brains and bodies function, which is why the framework pulls in these specialized psychological concepts to really analyze the impact. We're talking about things like attachment disruption, you know, how our capacity for future relationships gets damaged, and betrayal trauma.
And crucially, moral injury. That's a term we hear quite a bit, but maybe for listeners who haven't really encountered it before. How does the framework define moral injury compared to, say, just straightforward psychological trauma?
That's a good question. Moral injury is that lasting damage that happens when you witness something, or maybe you even perpetrate something, or fail to prevent acts that just deeply violate your core ethical beliefs. So in the context of betrayal, it's often that feeling of having your moral compass completely shattered because someone you trusted, maybe an institution you trusted, acted in a way that was fundamentally immoral. The framework suggests that healing requires moving beyond just the injury towards concepts like resilience and even post-traumatic growth. That's the positive psychological change that can sometimes come out of intense struggle.
Okay. And something that really stands out here, and I think it shows the framework's commitment to like holistic healing, is its recognition of hidden losses, what the source actually calls disenfranchised grief. This is grief that, well, society doesn't always recognize or really give space for, does it?
It's a really striking moment of compassion in the material, I found. Loss comes in so many forms, right? And one that is often minimized, pushed aside, is the loss of a beloved animal. The source explicitly includes animal companion grief, really honoring that specific kind of rupture. And for anyone reading the sources closely, they use this term zanines, which is basically just jargon for beloved pets or companion animals. It's a small detail, but it ensures that no form of deep supportive relationship loss is overlooked in this journey towards community care and remembrance. Now, what's truly fascinating as we sort of shift into the tools section is this deliberate fusion, this blending of spiritual disciplines with evidence-based coping mechanisms from psychology. The theological responses, they aren't just presented as, you know, historical ideas. They provide the essential language for processing suffering that psychology alone sometimes lacks.
That really feels like the key synthesis, doesn't it? The source requires us to understand and apply five core theological responses to harm and to do it responsibly. Let's break down maybe the function of the first three, lament, covenant, and theodicy. Why are there such essential anchors?
Well, lament is foundational. It really is, because it provides an ethical language for rage and grief. So instead of forcing the injured person to just instantly adopt passive acceptance or silence. The practice of lament actually gives legitimate voice to pain and anger, but without turning that pain destructively inward. It's presented as an ethical outlet that can help prevent the experience of harm from escalating into, say, deeper moral injury.
Okay, that makes sense. And covenant, that feels like a concept built entirely around trust and often broken trust.
Exactly. Covenant, in this specific context, it's about the idea of enduring foundational commitment. So when a relationship or maybe an institution breaks a trust, the framework uses these covenant concepts to help the individual refocus on their own unshakable commitments, maybe to their values, their community, their faith, even when others have failed them. It helps recenter their agency.
Right. It gives them something solid to hold on to. Then there's theodicy, which, okay, it sounds perhaps the most academic, but you could argue it's the most relevant when a betrayal just feels completely senseless, utterly unjust.
Uh-huh. Theodicy is, at its core, simply the intellectual attempt to grapple with why a good or just power, however one conceives, that allows evil or suffering to exist. Now, the source isn't saying you have to find an easy answer. Far from it. But it argues for the importance of finding a language for the question itself. By engaging with theodicy, the idea is the individual moves past that kind of paralyzing shock and begins the crucial meaning-making process, really wrestling with the nature of justice and injustice in the world.
Okay. Then rounding out the five, we have providence and hope. Now, providence here, it isn't about some kind of magical intervention, is it?
No, not really. Providence, as it's applied here, is more about the capacity to look back, sometimes long after the events, and discern some kind of guidance or meaning in confusing, painful experiences. It's a reflective process. And hope, again, it's not presented as just wishful thinking. It's defined more as an act of refusal to allow your history of suffering to dictate your future. It's a forward-leaning, intentional, moral orientation, a choice.
This brings up a really important question, though. How do we translate all that insight into practical action? Because, you know, theoretical concepts are only useful if they actually inform our behavior, right? How does the framework actually test these factors?
It does that by analyzing real-world material, which I think is crucial. They survey scriptural texts, historical accounts, and contemporary case studies. So actual instances where faith communities or individuals face massive betrayals and somehow navigated them. The goal is to identify, first, protective factors like what kept people ethically grounded under pressure, and second, restorative factors, what actions actually led to rebuilding trust or resilience.
Okay, so moving fully into the practical skills, now these are the concrete actions the learner, or you listening, can take right now to begin that healing process. What are the primary sort of intentional methods the framework emphasizes for fostering meaning making?
It really focuses on three structured practices. First, structured lament, which we touched on. But here it involves specific practices like writing or verbalizing grief in a particular guided form. The aim is to ensure the pain is processed constructively and ideally released. Second, there's reflective prayer or meditation. And the way it's framed, it's designed not necessarily to seek immediate answers, but more to foster stillness and self-awareness.
Right. And the third one is narrative reframing. That sounds critical because we all tell ourselves stories about our trauma, don't we? And those stories can either keep us stuck or potentially set us free.
Exactly. Narrative reframing is described as this conscious, careful process of revising the story of what happened to you. You don't change the facts of the betrayal, obviously. That's not the point. But you work to change your relationship to those facts. Maybe moving yourself from the role of just a passive victim to recognizing yourself as an active survivor who made choices, who learned lessons, even amidst the pain. That shift in narrative is seen as essential for post-traumatic growth.
Now, here's an area where I think a lot of clarity is needed, especially when dealing with betrayal. It's distinguishing the actions needed for your own personal healing versus those needed for relational repair. This seems to be where most people get tripped up, right? They assume personal release requires somehow dealing directly with the betrayer.
Absolutely. And the framework insists they are fundamentally separate pathways. This might be one of the most valuable distinctions it provides. It's about clearly differentiating forgiveness, reconciliation, and release.
Okay, let's unpack that, because understanding this distinction feels like it gives back a lot of autonomy. What's the operational difference between those three?
Okay, so release is described as the personal act. It's about letting go of the consuming psychological weight of the pain and resentment. Think of it as an internal boundary you set against continued suffering caused by holding on to it. It's for you. Forgiveness is also an internal shift, but it's more specific. It's choosing to stop holding the offense against the person. Often, this is primarily for one's own well-being, to break free from bitterness. But crucially, it requires zero interaction with the person who caused the harm.
Okay, so you can achieve release and you can achieve forgiveness entirely on your own terms. But what does that leave for reconciliation? How is that different?
Reconciliation is entirely different because it's relational. It requires mutual action. It often involves things like a renewed commitment, taking a risk on trust again, and usually requires genuine repentance and changed behavior from the offending party. Reconciliation demands active work from both sides to restore the relationship. And the framework is very clear that often isn't safe, appropriate, or even possible. So it explicitly teaches how to set ethical boundaries. And it outlines how to create safety and accountability plans so that the injured person knows, with certainty, that they can achieve wholeness and closure for themselves without ever having to reconcile with the person or institution that harmed them. That distinction really hands the power back to the injured party. Now, before we kind of synthesize the final framework, the source puts up a really important ethical guardrail. It's around the act of sharing these deeply personal experiences of harm.
Ah, yes. That's vital, isn't it? Especially in our digital age. When healing often involves sharing one story, whether in public or private, we have to evaluate the ethics of storytelling and representation. Why is this such a major concern in the source material?
Because healing stories can so easily become exploitative, unfortunately. The framework warns against sharing experiences in a way that just sensationalizes the trauma. Or worse, that strips the individual of their dignity, perhaps for the benefit of an audience or an institution. It basically mandates that any narrative engagement, any telling of the story, must uphold dignity, privacy, and truth. And importantly, it should focus on growth and learning, rather than just recounting trauma for spectacle or effect.
Okay, so pulling this all together then, what does this mean for you, the listener? The ultimate objective seems to be moving toward this proactive, sustainable restoration, synthesized across all these diverse inputs, the theological, the psychological, the practical.
Right. That culminating task, the end goal outlined, is designing a personalized, values-aligned resilience plan. It's like the final product of this whole process. It's where you take your theological insights or an understanding of, say, lament and hope, and you intentionally blend them with those evidence-based coping mechanisms we talked about, like narrative reframing, like boundary setting. It becomes a truly synthesized, personalized plan aimed at long-term ethical sustainability and well-being.
And just summing up the overall relevance then, this framework, it really provides clarity. Clarity on how to address ruptured trust, whether that's personal, institutional, or even spiritual. And it aims to nurture growth, not just for the individual going through it, but also for anyone who serves others, leaders, caregivers, community members, anyone who needs to understand the true cost and the real pathway of moral recovery after harm. So our deep dive today really showed us that healing from betrayal is in many ways an act of careful distinction. You can choose personal forgiveness and release, even if you never choose reconciliation. And that distinction itself is powerful, isn't it? Because it gives you absolute autonomy over your own recovery journey.
It does. And that distinction naturally leads us to our provocative thought for you to consider this week. If resilience planning involves blending these spiritual disciplines with evidence-based coping tools, how does the actual act of discerning, of choosing which specific evidence-based tools, maybe things like cognitive restructuring or perhaps structured exposure therapy, how does choosing which tools truly align with our deepest core theological or moral compass? How does that discernment become perhaps the single most crucial step in preventing moral injury from happening again? It forces us to ask, are the very tools we're using for recovery genuinely aligned with the unshakable values we are trying so hard to protect?